It's inventing, it's creating, it's literally sort of defining what the future is going to look like. In 100 years' time, people are going to look back and see what I did, and you know, I don't think there's a greater legacy you can leave.
The face of engineering is changing and evolving. But who are the faces behind it, and more specifically, the women? Let us take you on a journey of an exciting career that celebrates success and embraces failure. I'm your host, Ganan Adamu, and together with The Common Room, we bring you The Face of Engineering. Today, I'm in conversation with Sophie Harker.
My name is Sophie Harker. I'm a senior aerospace engineer at BAE Systems.
Now, it sounds really fascinating what you do, but first I want to find out from you, what inspired you or who inspired you to get into engineering?
Yeah, so I have a bit of an unusual route into engineering. I didn't do an engineering degree or an apprenticeship, I actually did a maths degree. Basically, since I was about 16 years old, I've wanted to be an astronaut, as ridiculous as that sounds, and I still do. When I was about 19 years old, I got an opportunity to meet Dr. Helen Sharman, who, for those who don't know, was the first British person in space back in 1991. And she was the first person to sort of say, have you thought about engineering? And I kind of just took that as gospel and went, okay, yeah, that's what I'm going to do. So I went straight into engineering from there, tailored my degree towards applied maths and got into BAE Systems in the graduate scheme.
That is crazy. What was it like meeting her?
I don't really get starstruck with people, but with her in particular, I was a bit sort of eyes wide. And I think if I met Tim Peake, for example, I think I'd also be a bit the same. But I just idolised them so much and, you know, want to be just like her. So it really was quite an intense moment for me when I was young. And I got to meet her about 6-7 years later. I can't quite remember how many years later. When I was working on a space plane project at the time. And that was amazing to be able to tell her that back when I was 19, she'd inspired me. And now I was working on something really cool and to get us into space. So.
And what did she say?
It was at like a public lecture. She was like, you should have said it in like one during the questions. But no, she was really sort of pleased for me. She just said that, thank you for telling me. And, you know, you always do all these outreach things, and it's something that I do a lot. It's really nice for her to be able to hear that what she told me has really made a difference and changed my life, because I wouldn't be an engineer now without her.
You know, and that kind of leads me nicely into, you know, what does being an engineer mean to you?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many things that the word engineer means. Back when I was young, up until I was about 19, I genuinely thought engineers, you know, fixed your satellite dish or your washing machine or whatever like that. I thought it was people that just fixed things. I thought it was mechanics, that sort of thing. The longer I'm in engineering, the more I realise that that's not really an accurate picture of what it is. It's inventing, it's creating, it's literally sort of defining what the future is going to look like. You're not just sort of fixing things that exist, you're creating the things that are going to exist in the future and designing those things. And that's what I love about it, is that in 100 years' time, people are going to look back and see what I did and what sort of legacy I left behind me. And I don't think there's a greater legacy you can leave.
You did maths at university, but in terms of being in the actual industry right now and where you are, is it as diverse as what you expected it to be, or is it not diverse and there needs to be more work?
To me, it was a bit of a shock, in all honesty. Because I did maths, the course is actually about 50-50 male-female, for example. There's a good mix of ethnicities on the course and things like that. It wasn't, it's probably one of the most diverse courses you can go on, actually, is maths. And then I joined the industry, and it was a bit of a shock. Not a lot of women, a lot of white men, like it's just generally everywhere. And it does need to change, and it is changing slowly. There's a lot of initiatives in place, sort of not just to sort of recruit more engineers and more diverse engineers, but to actually make sure once they're in the industry, they're properly supported throughout their careers, and not just sort of like in their early stages. And they are changing to ensure that support is there for everybody. It is accelerating. It's getting there. It is getting better.
And hearing so many of you, you know, young women and, well, I say young women, women all across the engineering field, you talk about engineering with so much passion. And I always think, God, if I had women like you coming into my school and telling me about engineering, I would have gone into engineering, because it just seems such a cool place to be. Now, can you remember the first thing you worked on?
I can, yes. I did an internship with BAE Systems between my third and fourth years at university, between like my degree and my master's. I wasn't really prepared for anything, but I ended up doing software engineering, and I've never done any software coding or anything like that in my life. And they kind of threw me in the deep end, and they just asked me to write an app for an existing product that they had in the armed forces that they were using sort of day to day, and they wanted like a tablet app version of it. And so I wrote that app, and as far as I'm aware, it's still in use, which is quite cool to think. Obviously, I can't tell you the details of what the app does, but I can say that I have one, and that's about all I can really say about it.
I love that, because everyone that I've spoken to so far says the same thing. Well, I've worked on this, but I can't tell you too much, you know. And I'm like, all right, then this seems quite cool. Maybe I might change careers just to be working on something really like exclusive. I love it. Now, is it true, Sophie, that you are one of the youngest engineers to have achieved a chartered engineer status?
Yeah, by accident. It wasn't intentional. Yeah, I was 25 at the time, and I was applying for incorporated status. So incorporated engineer and chartered engineer, kind of like professional registration titles that sort of prove that not only are you sort of a competent engineer and you're good at what you do, but you're also up to date in the latest sort of technologies and techniques and processes and things like that. So it's kind of like, if you were to be operated on, who would you rather be operated on? Someone that was up to date with the latest, least invasive techniques, or someone that hadn't looked at a book or been on a course in 20 years? So chartered and incorporated is like that. I originally went for incorporated, which is like one below chartered. And then my mentor saw my application and just sort of said, it's worthy of chartered. You probably not allowed it at the moment because of, unfortunately, the way the bylaws have come in, and it's just one of those weird things, but you can always apply and see. So I applied, I did get it, and then I got a call saying we're not allowed to give it to you because of these bylaws that had been written into the society's rules like long, long ago. It wasn't intentionally to be sort of an age restriction. It was just sort of the way that it felt, that you had to have the following like the previous experience and number of years and things like that, and it just happened to be that you had to be 26 to be able to apply. And so yes, we had to challenge a few of the bylaws. That's now, well, at the process of going through now, so that anybody can now apply at any age, which is great. Yeah, it's really good. I'm pleased that they've sort of not just done it for me and made it sort of like an exception for me. They've changed it long term, so hopefully you'll start to see younger people can beat my record, hopefully.
And you were also a winner of the IET's Young Women Engineer of the Year Award. And when was that, and what was that for?
That was in 2018, yeah. That was, it's an award they held every year for sort of young women in engineering who have been doing some sort of either working on exceptional things or doing things that challenge the status quo, or just generally being a good role model for young people. Both young boys, girls and such. And yeah, it was a bit of a surprise, a bit of a shock. I didn't expect to win it. It was a bit of a surprise. And it has completely changed my life since then. My whole life turned upside down. It was like having two full-time jobs with all this sort of extra stuff you do with it. But it's been the most amazing couple of years. Yeah, loved every minute of it.
Now, we've had conversations before, and you know, it is true that you do want to go into space at some point.
Yes, yeah, it is. Yeah, I'm still going for it, hoping to apply for the European Space Agency's next round.
And what's the process like?
So it's a really hard one, because there isn't really like a sort of standard route you can go. There's so many different things. Like, the minimum requirement for the European Space Agency is to have a master's degree in some kind of STEM subject, so some kind of science, technology, engineering, or maths, and then 3 years' experience in a relevant field. So for me, that's aerospace. It could be in medicine, it could be in teaching. Or you could have a certain number of pilot hours instead and be sort of a fast jet or helicopter pilot as Tim Peake is. That's all your requirements are. That is it. And to be fit and healthy, which doesn't sound that hard. Everyone's like, oh yeah, you can do that. That's no problem. Where it comes into being difficult is standing out above everybody else. So when ESA put the call out for Tim Peake's round about 10 to 15 years ago now, they got, I think, if I remember the numbers correctly, around 8,000 to 10,000 applications. Yeah, and they only selected 6.
Do you know when they will announce these rounds, or is it kind of ad hoc?
It's very ad hoc. They were meant to announce around this year. Obviously, things have probably delayed that. So it was never confirmed. It wasn't like, oh, we were going to announce on this date and we're postponing. It was never sort of confirmed that. It was more rumours going around that sort of the UK Space Agency had come out saying, yeah, we think it's going to be later this year or as early as this year. But that's kind of been a bit delayed a little bit. If you look at NASA and the American selection process, they tend to put a call out every other year or so, quite often, and they can recruit anywhere from 2 to 15 astronauts in one go. but not all of them get to fly. Whereas with ESA, when you are selected, you will definitely fly at some point. Fingers crossed with the Artemis mission, so the return mission to the moon, that will hopefully put the first woman on the moon as well. And a few other sort of like ramp ups of human space flight should mean that there will at least be one other call in my sort of age lifetime. So hopefully I will get two shots, if not successful on the first. We'll have to see. It is very uncertain. You just got to do your best in the meantime.
Wow. So one of the biggest questions I want to ask you is, what are you most proud of so far in terms of what you've achieved?
Technically, I think one of the things I'm most proud of is the hypersonic work I did in my previous role. So hypersonics means going faster than Mach 5, so five times the speed of sound. It's quite fast, that, considering we normally fly in an airplane around Mach 0.7, Mach 0.8, and fast jets go about Mach 2.5 and Mach 3 is a real push. So we're talking really fast there. And so I was working on things that no one else in the world was looking at, and I got to sort of direct where I wanted the company sort of research to go, which was amazing. And it ended up with a contract between sort of my company, Rolls-Royce, and Reaction Engines with the MOD. So I'm probably most proud technically of that one, because wow, it really left a bit of a legacy in the company for me, which is that. But in terms of sort of more personal, I think it's probably just all of the STEM outreach I do, and like going into schools or doing the lectures and going online and talking to people and things like that. I'm probably most proud of all of that work. And in particular, one instance, I was with the Institution of Engineering Technology, the IIT, who gave me that YWE award. And they ran a competition with the Beano and asking kids to sort of draw and design what they couldn't live in space without. So if they were going to go to Mars and they had to bring something with them and they had to adapt it to work on Mars, what was it they couldn't live without? So whether it was like a football or whether it was like their phone, whatever it was, like what couldn't they live without? And the winner was actually a little girl who designed a clarinet that worked in space, and it was amazing. It was really impressive.
I love that.
It was so cool. I really recommend looking it up, because the photo of it is unbelievable, because we built it, we actually made it, and we actually sent it to space. We sent it on a weather balloon to the edge of space.
Oh my God.
The photo you see of it, yeah, it's mad. Like, people always ask, is it real? And it definitely is. As far as we know, it's the only and the first and only clarinet that's been in space. And that day was just amazing, because the little girl was just so excited to see me. And it was, you know, not like an ego stroke, like, oh, she's just really excited to see me. It wasn't that. It was more, she was so enthusiastic about what I was doing and engineering and space and physics and all those sort of things. And then she sent me like a thank you note afterwards, where she'd drawn like me in space, and she'd drawn like the day she'd had. And she was just so happy with everything that happened that day, that just sort of made me realize that all the work that I do and all the outreach and all the hours that I put into these things are so worth it, because it really does make a difference to them. So I think that's probably my proudest moment, is that moment.
I love that. And you know what, and that's why it's so important when we talk about diversity. Is there more that the world of engineering can do to support diversity?
Yeah, there really is. The really easy answer to is, you know, reach more kids, encourage more kids. I'm reluctant to use that as like the answer, because it's once you've got them recruited and into engineering, then what? Like, you can't just leave them, because structurally these things aren't set up for women and people of color. They're just not. And so we have to make sure that we're supporting them throughout their careers. We have to make sure that we're changing things. So, for example, a really good thing that we've done recently with the Royal Aeronautical Society is have take a look at their bylaws and remove anything that could potentially discriminate against people unintentionally. So it's sort of a systemic built-in biases that we just don't realise are in there. Credit to them for taking the criticism on and changing it all. And it is that sort of thing that I feel needs to happen, and we really need to take it down. And then above all that, we just need to make sure that the public face of engineering is not still a white guy in overalls with a spanner and oil and things like that. There are a few like that. Like, I'm not saying nobody looks like that, but nobody has the sort of hands-on job. But the majority isn't. And if we continue to sort of push that picture out there, then we're going to continue to recruit the same sort of people. And in engineering, it's so important not to recruit the same people, because you need diversity of thought and experience. And if you don't have that sort of diversity in there, you're developing a project for a minority. Like, the really good example that I use quite a lot is seatbelts in cars. up until a certain date were designed with male crash test dummies. So women were statistically more likely to die in a car crash, which is just madness. Yeah. And so you can tell that that sort of decision process didn't have a single woman in there whatsoever.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's just sort of a gender-based one, but there's so many others that affect other sort of protected characteristics that without that sort of experience and sort of, oh, have you thought about this? You're not really designing your full product set at all properly.
And this is where, you know, it kind of leads me on to mentoring and also reverse mentoring. Is that something that is actually done within the industry?
Yeah, I'd say there's quite a bit. I'd say more with our sort of senior levels. They're quite keen on it. And I think because the generation coming through has definitely got very different priorities and opinions to previous generations. So there's definitely been a lot of, sort of our senior management I've seen in the industry seeking it out. And one of the things that I've seen that has been brilliant is they're actively sort of supporting their young engineers. So they're advocating for them, they're listening to them, and they're actually taking their ideas on board at a very senior level, which is making a huge difference, because it's not just about, you know, supporting them to progress in a career line and smashing ceilings and all those sort of things. It is sometimes just about being heard and making sure that whatever you're suggesting is being listened to and enacted. And I'm seeing that a lot in the industry, which is really, really good. Am I seeing enough of it? I would like to see a bit more, but it's a start, and they're getting there. And I think the more we advocate for it, the more we show that it's successful, which it has been on a really, really, really good level, then the more I think we'll get more people encouraging that and taking up on that offer.
And, you know, and that's true. I think in any industry, we need reverse mentoring to be able to develop them, but also retain that talent, which at times they have so many initiatives that, yeah, you get them in, but then they don't last long because they don't feel that the environment is inclusive for them.
Exactly, yeah. And it's just a waste of time for everybody, and it's just not a way forward. Like, what's the point in investing all this time and energy to get people in the door and then leave them at the doorstep? You've got to make sure that they're included and that they can be their whole selves wherever they are and supported throughout their entirety of their time with you. It's not a, you know, once they're in, you give up, that's it. There is more to be done.
So for you, Sophie, what is a typical day like in the world of engineering?
Yeah, I don't think there is a typical day, and you'll hear that answer a lot from all of us. Yeah, because it does just change every day. Like, some days I'll be on back-to-back calls and workshops, and I'll be solutionizing, trying to get somebody would have brought me a problem, and we would be talking to subject matter experts and bringing in sort of some of our suppliers, for example, and trying to work out the solution to these problems. Some days I'll be heads down all the way at my computer all day, trying to solve a mathematical problem or trying to work through a model and trying to get that to work. And some days I'll be at a rocket firing test. So it's so different. And it just depends where in engineering you are. So you'll hear a different answer from me being in aerospace to someone who's in automotive or somebody who is in green energy, for example. You'll hear just different answers across the board, because we all do different things. And that's what makes engineering such a great career, because whatever you're interested in, whatever you like doing, whatever you don't like doing, you don't have to do. And you can just sort of tailor your career to what you really enjoy best. And that, I don't think you get that anywhere else. That's the best part.
So one of the things that I've looked at, especially with engineers and scientists, is that, you know, your role is in effect is to make the world a better place. But also when it's used for bad, it can create wars and be used, you know, can used to fight wars. But what would be your ideal world to live in, or for everyone to live in? What would you have?
What would I have? Ooh. I mean, I'm not a massive eco warrior, but I'm a bit of an eco warrior. So I think being able to have everything recycled is a big one for me. I find it really frustrating that, you know, when you're using things that you can't recycle things, and there exist things. It's like one of my big ones is microwave meal dishes. Like, I don't understand why, like, we can make them that are. Why are we still making ones specifically that can't be? It just doesn't make sense to me. And it is this shift, this culture shift that comes with that. So that is one of my big ones. And then sort of the electric car industry, I think, really needs well, it's on its way up, thankfully. And I really hope that it starts to take off globally, not just sort of in a minute few countries.
So what would be your dream role? I know you're doing your dream job, but if you were Sophie at the age of 40, 45, what would be your dream role?
Yeah, I mean, hopefully I'd be in space. That is the dream. Hopefully engineering in space, that's the goal. If not, doing something space and hypersonic related, I think is pretty cool, sort of being a chief engineer and that sort of thing. So really having the decision-making power and leaving my legacy, my decisions on a product, that would be amazing, to really know that when it's flying or when it's in space that I did that, like I had something and I played a really important role in that. That I think that's the dream for me.
And finally, when you talk to young people about engineering, what would you say is like your tagline or your quote?
Yeah, I've got two taglines. I've got one is that whatever you're interested in, engineering can take you there. Like whatever you're passionate about, whatever you love, it can take you there. You don't just have to be an end user of a product. You can be right at the beginning, whether that's your phone, your iPad or whatever, or whether it's makeup or whether it's, you know, furniture, believe it or not, like has to have product designers, which are types of engineers. So there's all sorts of different things. If you're really interested in something, you can follow it into engineering. So that's my first one. And then my second one is there's no such thing as a stereotypical engineer in every sense. So you don't have to change who you are, what you look like, what you enjoy, what you don't enjoy. Like I'm not what you would imagine an aerospace engineer is like. I don't look like the majority of engineers and I don't sound or act like them. I act like me and the things that I enjoy, like I'm a dancer and a figure skater, and that's not a normal hobby for an engineer, but I wouldn't change it for the world. And I really think that the more we have people that embrace exactly who they are and that people reward them for embracing who they are, then the better our sort of engineering in the UK and globally will be.
That was Sophie Harker, rewriting bylaws, planning a future among the stars, and proven along the way that there's no such thing as a stereotypical engineer. I hope you enjoyed listening to Sophie's ambitions. Next up, we talk to electrical engineer Dr. Ozak Esu on The Face of Engineering.